Hello, welcome to the House of Comments. This is a weekly podcast where we talk about the politics of the previous week. I'm Mark Thompson. I used to be a Lib Dem blogger and activist, but now I'm just an independent blogger and sort of activist, as much as you can be outside of a party. Normally, I would have with me my co-host Emma Burnell, but as anyone listening last week will have heard, Emma went in for an operation earlier this week. I'm pleased to say that she is recovering well. I've been in touch with her, so hopefully she'll be back on soon. But in her absence this week, I'm delighted to be joined by Mark Ferguson, who is editor of Labour List. Good evening, Mark.
Hello.
Hello. Great to have you. And also, I'm very pleased to be joined by Charlotte Henry, who is a freelance journalist and Lib Dem. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi, nice to be on finally. We've been trying to sort it out for a while, so I'm excited to be on.
I was going to say that we've had a couple of abortive attempts at this, but it's not worked, so it's great to finally get you on. And in a momentous week, the biggest story of the last few days is, of course, the fact that Nelson Mandela died on, I think it was late on Thursday evening. Now, Nelson Mandela had been ill for a long time, and actually, about 3 or 4 months ago, me and Emma did have a very brief discussion at the end of one episode when she'd noticed that there were rumours that he might be very close to the end. But he wasn't at that point, but he has now passed away. Mark, do you want to start us off just with your kind of thoughts? I mean, your memories, and presumably you remember when he was released, but you probably don't remember when he first went in. I don't think any of us are old enough to remember when he was first jailed.
I do remember when he was released, but I was only about 5 or 6 years old. So I think for a lot of people my age, sort of late 20s, early 30s, Nelson Mandela's never been an ordinary politician or even a cause. He's always been this sort of elevated figure, this sort of almost saintly idea of goodness. And I think it's quite hard for people of my generation to think of this person as a campaigner or an activist or even a politician, which is of course what he is.
Yeah, and it's interesting that, isn't it? Because he did transcend that and became this global figure. I mean, I saw a piece by Peter Oborn in the Telegraph the other day, who was comparing him to Jesus Christ. I mean, I retweeted that because I thought it was an interesting article, not because I agreed with the headline. And I got a bit of stick, people saying, you know, people saying about that headline. But I mean, he is one of very few figures who maybe in, say, hundreds of years time will still be remembered from the 20th century, isn't he?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's only a few people get remembered universally from any century, which I guess should be a fairly chastening thought for would be members of the cabinet or shadow cabinet who might be trying to make their mark. That, to be honest, maybe only a handful of prime ministers, maybe only a handful of presidents, but there'll only be maybe two or three people mentioned in the same breath as Nelson Mandela when we come to look back on the past century. Maybe Winston Churchill, maybe Kennedy, maybe Gandhi, and Mandela's sort of the last of those great figures of the 20th century.
Yeah. Charlotte, what are your thoughts? So presumably you're too young even to remember him coming out. You're very young, aren't you?
Pretty much. Yeah. I don't remember him coming out, but I think that for me, that only reinforces what Mark has said, actually, that he sort of transcended this idea of being a foreign leader and a foreign politics and took on this almost this saintly sort of persona. Actually, I had quite a strange experience on Thursday night because I was out having a drink with a friend, and then I got a message from my father saying Nelson Mandela had died. So I was there in this bar, and me and my friend knew the news and other people didn't. And then I realised I was literally around the corner from Leicester Square, where, by the weirdest of coincidences, the premiere of his film was taking place. So there was a film of his life being premiered in Leicester Square, and the news was just coming through that he passed away at the age of 95.
Yeah.
So actually, I sort of took myself down to Leicester Square, and it was quite a strange experience because there were people around who didn't know what happened, who were just there celebrity spotting, you know, from the premiere. And then the news sort of filtered through. And the people who were at the premiere, not the celebrity, sort of just filed out, and there were people shocked, there were people crying. I think apparently the film was very intense anyway, and it'd been quite an intense atmosphere. But actually, I think it kind of quite hit people, him to have gone, because everyone sort of has a memory, a story, an impression of Mandela.
Yeah. So I mean, I do remember him coming out quite clearly. I mean, I show my age now, but I was 15 or 16 when Mandela was released. And I remember it was covered live on television when he came to make a speech. And I think for people of my generation, probably just slightly older, I mean, I remember the specials with Free Nelson Mandela, and he was a big political figure in the 1980s. And I, because I was only a child, I wasn't really fully aware of what that was all about. It's only as I've got older in retrospect, and, you know, and as he was released, and then obviously the history of South Africa changed quite radically after he was released, quite rapidly as well, actually. And maybe we can just talk a little bit about that, because I mean, I've read a lot of commentary in the last few days about how things could have been very different, because when he came out of prison, he appeared to harbour no bitterness and no, you know, no very harsh feelings against the people who jailed him. And instead, he became a unifying and consensual figure who reached out across the political divides in his country and helped to heal those wounds. One of the reasons why very quickly things were able to change, you know, with the whole kind of Truth and Reconciliation Committee. But if he'd come out and been a bit different, you know, and I don't think anyone would have blamed him if he'd have been very, very angry and had expressed that anger and that had come through in his politics. But maybe the history of South Africa would have been very different. Mark, what do you think?
I guess it's one of those great unknowns, isn't it? Because 3 decades is, depending on the kind of person, an amount of time during which you could amass a sort of insurmountable amount of anger. Or with another kind of person, it seems Nelson Mandela was that kind of person, it's really hard to stay angry for 27 years before you start to try and think about how you can make the situation that you're in better, the situation for your fellow countrymen. I mean, the thing that's very touching for me is the idea that when Nelson Mandela was inaugurated as president, many of his jailers were there in the front row. Such
was an extraordinary story, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. But I mean, he said that that storing up hatred is like drinking poison and expecting it to kill your enemies, which I think, you know, I mean, Nelson Mandela, you know, for all that Nelson Mandela achieved, actually, he has stored up this sort of remarkable number of wonderful quotes about things as diverse as war and peace and education and the meaning of knowledge and the meaning of power and community and you know, it turns out, as well as being one of the great political leaders, revolutionaries and politicians of the 20th century, also a pretty quotable guy as well, which is not a bad achievement. And actually, someone who very clearly also had a wicked sense of humour. When he spoke at Labour Party conference in 2000, he said, in my country, they send you to prison first, then they make you president. Or alternatively, he said, I'm here as a old unemployed ex-convict.
Yeah, that was my favourite line I've heard going around the last couple of days. I thought that was very funny. And also, without even trying, sort of shows the humility of the man, doesn't it?
Yeah. Charlotte, what do you think about the idea of, you know, how different things could have been and how the South Africa that came out of the 90s was very much in his image? I mean, do you think that's right? Do you think it could have happened without him?
No, and I think I'm a huge sports fan, and actually I think some of the key moments in sort of South Africa's progression can be highlighted by sport. So there's obviously the famous Springbok rugby tournament, where Mandela appeared in the shirt of the Springbok rugby team, which was seen as the white man's team. And that had such a unifying effect because obviously it's a huge, huge sport in South Africa. And as a huge football fan, the other thing that stands out to me is the South African players dancing out the tunnel in their home World Cup. And what an extraordinary moment that was, because, you know, that only was 20 odd years since Mandela's release. And it was, South Africa was at the forefront of the world. And I thought that was pretty extraordinary.
Yeah.
Now, of course, there are all sorts of issues around crime, health, huge, huge, huge swathes of poverty, HIV, things that South Africa have never really managed to get to grips with. But I mean, we'll never know what would have happened if Mandela had been different. Would South Africa have descended to sort of a Zimbabwe under the way Mugabe has? But I think it's clear that under Mandela's leadership, he brought South Africa into the mainstream of the international community. And that's a pretty extraordinary thing if you think about where it came from.
Yeah. I mean, there's been some commentary, pretty muted, but you know, I've seen it surfacing about, you know, his history and his time before he went to jail, and you know what happened, you know, to what led to him going to jail. I mean, I've seen some people trying to compare him with, you know, people like Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness, and, you know, basically trying to question why he's being lauded in the way that he is. Mark, what would you say to people who say that?
I think Peter Hain made a very good point. Peter Hain, obviously the Labour MP for Neath, who knew Mandela very well and was an anti-apartheid activist in the 70s.
Yeah.
I think Peter Hain put it very well today when he said a lot of people were a bit squeamish about Mandela backing limited armed activities against the state. But he said that's a bit like, you know, taking umbrage at people in the French resistance, taking up arms against occupiers. Now, it wasn't an occupying army as such, but it was very much the majority of the country were under the yoke of a powerful minority. And I think it's very easy to sort of sit in London or elsewhere in the UK and say that we should abhor violence. But when you're having violence rain down upon you, it's very difficult to take that position yourself. And actually, the fact that Mandela had used violence but then renounced it is, I think, a very powerful part of his story and the way that he was able to move on from that.
Yeah. And I mean, he's the first to say that he himself was a sinner who was trying. You know, he never claimed to be this saint, this kind of saintly figure that he in his latter years has been painted as. And I imagine now that he's died, that will continue. But he certainly would never have made that claim for himself. He knew where he'd come from and what he'd done. And like you say, he renounced it.
There's also another point which I think is important here. That's why I find the comparisons to the Gerry Adams and the Martin McGuinness is quite crass. And that's the ANC, as I understand it, and Nelson Mandela never, ever targeted human life. They wanted to cause economic disruption, but they never wanted to cause injury, and certainly didn't want to cause death, even to their enemies. And I think while the violence is violent, I think that's an important distinction we should bear in mind when we have to have this debate, as we do.
Mm. And just while we're on this, I mean, I don't particularly want to dwell on this, partly because I don't think it's the right time. But, you know, we may not discuss Mandela again, perhaps for a long time. I mean, I do remember during the 80s that there were some on the right, some in the Conservative Party as well, who, you know, said pretty horrendous things about Nelson Mandela, and even Margaret Thatcher didn't particularly seem to think that, you know, he was his cause was in particular, you know, particularly worthy of her attention. I mean, I'm being a bit careful how I phrase this, because I think there was some ambivalence, and I've certainly seen some comments along the lines of, you know, Margaret Thatcher didn't think that if, you know, she was to come out to bat for Mandela, that would have been particularly helpful. And I think there might have been some behind the scenes stuff. But Mark, from your perspective, what do you think about that?
I think the sort of the really extreme stuff, the hang Nelson Mandela stuff that you saw from a very small number of Conservative students was awful. And clearly that was part of the reason that Norman Tebbit and others in the Conservative Party moved to actually basically get rid of the young Conservatives. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any suggestion that Thatcher or others subscribe to that point of view, although she did once refer to him as a terrorist. I think I think it's an excellent opportunity to look back at politics, something we see is so clear now. People should have backed Nelson Mandela. That was the right thing to do. But seen through the prism of 1980s politics, with it being seen as a proxy as part of the Cold War, well, what happens if the ANC won? Wouldn't they side with the communists? People like Joe Slovo, part of the anti-apartheid movement, very much were communists. It just goes to show that whilst we can have real clarity looking back, it's very, very difficult to make those decisions and stand up and do the right thing at the time. Mm. And the Conservative Party did not, you know, handle the ANC and Mandela as well as those of us looking back might wish they had. But I actually can, to a certain extent, understand why they found themselves in that position, even though I think that they were fundamentally wrong.
Yeah, and it is quite fascinating, actually. There's a series, is it Dominic Sambrook on BBC4, about the Cold War in the last few weeks. I think it finished a couple of weeks ago. And watching that, I don't remember him mentioning Mandela, but certainly it does make you realise that the Cold War was a very different time. And there were very different priorities. And because it all sort of changed overnight in 1989 when the Berlin Wall fell, it is easy to forget that actually to look back at what happened decades ago with, you know, modern perspective, it isn't always fair, and you're not always taking everything into account. Mark, go on.
I also think it's a good way a prism to look at a lot of contemporary issues, things that we might think are incredibly complex now, but actually in 20 years time we're going to look back on them and either feel like we were right or wrong in the decisions that we made now. There's a certain amount of clarity that you get with the passing of time, but sometimes I wish we could apply some of that clarity in the here and now.
Yeah, indeed. Charlotte, what do you think?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. I think it is fair to look at the responses of politicians from across the spectrum in the context of their time. I think it's worth pointing out that Thatcher did put some quite stringent, restrictions and made things quite tough for South Africa in a way to end apartheid. But and that also the right-wing fringes of the Conservatives were just that. It was sort of some young sort of loudmouths trying to get some attention from what I can tell. So I think it is fair to look at things in the context of their time as well. I mean, people were hardly saying the type of things we heard, you know, American governors saying, employing segregation in the UK. I mean, that just wasn't happening. So I think we can look at it in that context. But I also think what's really struck me, looking back at Mandela over the last few years, and like you say, I wasn't really aware of him during his pomp, as it were, is actually it makes me feel kind of sad at the lack of grandness, if you like, of our current leaders, and that's across the spectrum, across the world. I don't see that we have these great leaders anymore, whether, you know, we don't have the Kennedys, the Reagans, the post-war, the Churchills, the post-war presidents that rebuilt countries. And it's, I think, in a way, Mandela was the last of his type, and I think that's why it's hit so many of us over the last few days.
Yeah,
I think there is an argument, though, that whilst many of us are interested in politics, and many people who aren't politically active, who for whatever reason find that politics turns them off, do hanker for those sort of big political figures. But
correct.
Those political figures quite often come along at times of huge political and social upheaval. There is something to be said, although it's sometimes disappointing to have small figures being quite prominent in politics, there's also something to be said for living at a time of small politics. Frankly, I'd rather be having the kind of debates that we have in Britain, which might seem relatively small, than having the kind of debates they had in 1960s and 70s South Africa, which were huge.
Yeah, it's like the old Chinese curse, isn't it? May you live in interesting times.
Quite.
Yeah. And maybe we should be grateful our times aren't quite as interesting. Okay, well, I think we should move on. Having marked Nelson Mandela's life there, back to domestic politics, which, as I was talking to Charlotte earlier on today, as we were organising this, and I was thinking, what political stuff's happened in the last few days? And she reminded me of the Autumn Statement, which was only last Thursday, which shows how quickly things move on. Mark, do you just want to give us your take on what happened on Thursday, what was announced, and maybe if you can give us your thoughts on Ed Balls' response?
Yeah, sure. It's an acutely political occasion, the Autumn Statement now, isn't it? It's sort of an opportunity to close the political year for the Chancellor to stand up and read out what you might disparagingly call sort of tractor stats. I don't actually really remember anything less than a week ago now that George Osborne said that I think particularly moves the debate one way or another, that will have a particular impact when we come to the general election in 18 months' time. And there has been a lot of talk about Ed Balls's response to the Autumn Statement, and that, you know, he will have better days in the Commons than that. That's absolutely for sure. However, in terms of, do I actually think that's going to have any tangible impact upon whether or not people think that he's able to be Chancellor, whether or not that people are going to vote Labour or not? No, because the kind of people who are watching the Autumn Statement at lunchtime on a Thursday in December, rather than doing their Christmas shopping online at work, probably have decided who they could be voting for already.
Charlotte, what do you think? Are you quite as generous to Ed Balls as Mark's just been?
I'll give you three guesses. First of all, I thought Ed Balls was absolutely atrocious. And the hypocrisy of him saying I was being drowned out and sort of bullied by 300 Tories is just beyond belief. because this is the man that sat on the front bench for 3 years making flatline gestures and heckling. So the idea that he was getting a dose of his own medicine and didn't like it is a bit pathetic, I think.
There's a bit of a difference between wobbling your hand at George Osborne and having 300 people scream bloody murder at you for half an hour, though.
Sure, but I mean, he did also start with, this chancellor is in denial, when he has for 3.5 years denied the mess he's made. So I think it was a laughable response.
Charlotte, just on that, though, because isn't there a little bit of a point here that Ed Balls has a stammer, and it felt to me like what the Tories were trying to do was get him to stammer his words so they could laugh and point at him. And that feels like bullying.
I don't know. I mean, I think the whole spectacle of politics and debate, you know, these big set piece debates in the chamber are rather tired anyway. I very rarely see a debate, someone's performance at the dispatch box that makes me change my opinion of them, or like Mark says, I think will shift the dial in any way. But I think the problem for Ed Balls is he is at the point now where he has to look like the Chancellor in waiting. George Osborne did for a good few years, and I really do not see that Ed Balls has established himself with that. And never mind the barracking, his response was not substantive enough. It was just so weak and lily-livered that actually he didn't look like a chancellor in waiting at all, and that does matter. And even if people are not saddos like us three sitting watching the autumn statement at 12:30 on a Thursday, you do have to get your soundbites in. You do have to build momentum around you. You do have to have the front pages of the paper saying how well you did, and he couldn't achieve any of that. And it was it was so clearly Osborne's day.
I've read some coverage of this that's talked about how Osborne last week managed to wrest control of the political agenda back from Labour, who in the last few weeks, you know, let's be honest, have had a good time of it. Yep. This whole narrative that they have about, you know, focusing on cost of living crisis and the energy prices and all of that, it has really felt like Ed Miliband has been in control. Mark, do you think that Osborne has now wrested the political initiative back again? And do you think he's going to be able to hold it there like Linton Crosby desperately wants him to?
I don't really know what it is that George Osborne is meant to have said last week, other than he delivered his statement slightly better than Ed Balls delivered his. I don't see how that particularly has changed the dynamics. I mean, there was a poll came out, a snap poll from Ipsos Mori the next morning that said instinctively, here is what George Osborne said, here is what Ed Balls said, who do you agree with? And it was 2-1 in favour of Ed Balls. Now, I'm not suggesting that Ed Balls has been sort of hardly done by here by the media, although I think at times there is an element of that. I do think fundamentally people don't really care if growth is 2.4% instead of 1.8%. That's good. That sounds nice. It's heading in the right direction and we should all be very happy about it. But if the amount of money you've got in your pocket is staying the same or getting worse, then those are just numbers being read out by guys in suits on TV. That has absolutely no impact upon you. And every time David Cameron or George Osborne say Labour wants to talk about cost of living, they don't want to talk about the economy, that just sounds baffling to a lot of people to whom the economy is how much money you've got in your pocket, how much your rent or your mortgage is, whether or not you can afford childcare for your kids.
It actually looks, though, Mark, I mean, just looking ahead slightly, that by the autumn of next year, there is a reasonable chance that that wages will be increasing faster than inflation. And isn't there a real risk that although Labour have regain the initiative in recent weeks and months, that they've hitched themselves to a real hostage to fortune here, and that if things flip around and things are, you know, are moving in the correct direction in terms of cost of living, then what they've been ramping up in the run-up to the next election will suddenly just make them fall flat on their face?
Well, look, one, Robert Choate from the OBR said today that he didn't believe that we'd be seeing any real improvement in wages or the cost of living for maybe another 2 years past the next general election. So, you know, it's a hostage to fortune both ways. Everything in politics is a hostage to fortune one way or the other. But fundamentally, Labour's message needs to evolve now into not just don't vote for them, you're going to get worse off. It needs to become vote for us, you'll be better off, and here's what it is. And it needs to move beyond things like small tax breaks to businesses to encourage them to get a few people onto the living wage, or even the energy price freeze, which has been very successful politically, but fundamentally is only
a con. Fundamentally,
well, it's not a con, but it's a £200 answer to a £1,600 problem. and people are going to start to notice that.
Charlotte?
I don't really know where to begin, actually, because I think Labour lack so much credibility and so much substance on the economy. I mean, I think one thing we should talk about, Mark, actually, you as an ex-Lib Dem and me as a still-standing Lib Dem, as it were, is actually this Tory tax cut, the marriage tax cut, which seems to be the only sort of policy thing that's wangled its way into the autumn statement. Because like Mark Ferguson said, basically most of it is tractor stats and not very interesting. But they did get in this, finally get in their marriage tax break. And the Lib Dems moved very, very quickly to disown that. I mean, when you've got the Chief Secretary of the Treasury writing to his party referring to a government policy as a Tory tax break, they dealt with it very well. There was no big dispute. You know, there was no split in the coalition. It was just what everyone thought. But it was interesting. And I thought, apart from that, it was a very Lib Dem autumn statement, which I'm quite comfortable with. But the Tories have finally grabbed onto this tax break, which, I mean, the tax break itself is a nonsense as well. But it's interesting they use the autumn statement to start wedging themselves apart on economic detail.
Yeah. I mean, I'm an ex-Lib Dem, recovering Lib Dem. And I don't have a problem with the fact that the Lib Dems have taken a step back and allowed the Tories to push this through. The Lib Dems aren't going to vote for it, but they're not going to vote against it either. And therefore, by default, it goes through. But it was in the coalition agreement, and that's what happens in coalitions.
I think
the Lib Dems' approach to it is spot on. Let them get on with it and then, you know, use it as a weapon to beat them over the head with, because it is...
Let people decide if they like it or
exactly.
not.
Exactly. Well, in my view, it's bloody stupid. You know,
it's entirely stupid and meaningless.
Yeah,
and
but I think there's a real risk that we'll just break out in agreement on this podcast, because I suspect Mark F agrees with us on that as well.
Absolutely, it's a £3 answer to a £1,600 problem for only a tiny fraction of the people who need that kind of help. Frankly, I wish they'd allotted that money to fully fund the free school meals pledge that Nick Clegg did at a conference, which actually I think is one of the best policies that any of the major parties came out with at conference season.
Yeah, hear, hear. I actually wish they could have gone further and done it for older children as well. But, you know, maybe in years to come, they'll be able to extend. It's certainly easier to extend once you've got a policy in place than to introduce it in the first place. And I imagine George Osborne felt quite uncomfortable making the announcement about the marriage tax allowance, because he doesn't want it. It's Cameron that wants it. And Osborne's been forced to do it. And I think Cameron will live to regret it, actually. Because I just don't think it makes any sense. And I think, you know, as usual with tax changes, the winners will quietly bank their winnings and not say anything, and the losers will be apoplectic. And rightly so, you know, widowed parents and, you know, just all sorts of people who, through no fault of their own, you know, abused spouses who have to leave their partner, suddenly they don't get this break either. It's horrendous politics, really. And, you know, I'm sure the amount of cases that the press are going to be able to find and point to examples of people who are really badly wronged by this, I'm amazed. But I don't know, maybe the press is behind it for their own reasons, for moralistic reasons or something.
Also, just to be financial about this for a moment, how many years would it take for the marriage tax allowance to cover the cost of the average British wedding, which is pretty comfortably in five figures? I mean, no one's going to be getting married or staying married because they're going to get a few pounds a week extra. No. Frankly, that is dwarfed by the rise in inflation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, just one final point before we move on from this. Do we actually need an autumn statement? I mean, it feels to me like this forever, you know, autumn statements and budgets and, you know, it feels like we're only ever a few weeks or a couple of months away from another set piece budgetary type announcement. Shouldn't we just get rid of them and go back to having budgets once a year?
Well, we're sort of beholden to the tyranny of Chancellor as strategist, aren't we? It started under Gordon Brown and it's kicked up a gear under George Osborne. These are opportunities for these would-be potential future prime ministers and leaders of their parties to set out their stall, what they've done, to profess on what they consider to be their great victories. They don't really bring anything in terms of political debate. They don't really change anything. I'd be much happier, to be honest, if we had a once-a-year State of the Union delivered by the Prime Minister and once-a-year budget.
Yeah. Charlotte, would you get rid?
I would, actually, but I'd also get rid of Prime Minister's questions, because I don't think we learn anything from either of them.
Yeah.
I think many of these set-piece spectacles are really rather pointless. They are a combination of pre-written statements whipped, you know, printed, pre-designed questions. And those of us in the public, we just don't get to learn about anything new.
Mm. Yeah, I agree. And now, having slagged off MPs quite a lot, I'm going to reverse ferret and defend their pay rise, because that's the other big story of the last couple of days, which is that it's been announced that shock horror MPs are going to get an 11% pay rise, which I'm going to unpack in a minute, actually, because I don't agree with even the headline. But Mark, what are your thoughts on this? Do you think that the MPs deserve a rise?
I'm not sure whether they deserve a rise or don't deserve a rise. I think what we need to do is we need to decide what level is an acceptable amount to pay MPs. And I'm fairly agnostic about that. I do think what politicians and political nerds might call the optics of it is fairly dreadful. The idea of a £10,000 pay rise, even though it's over 3 years, so it's three much smaller pay rises. I do think it looks pretty bad at a time when wages are being held down, especially those in the public sector that voted on by those very same MPs, at a time when, because of political squabbling, attempts to reduce the size of the House of Commons have not happened. Now, I personally think that would have been a mistake, but still, there was an attempt to cut the price of politics. We're now going to increase the price of politics. It's all looking a bit of a mess. I'll just try and suck the toxicity out of it straight away, say this is how much MPs are going to be paid, and from now on, it's being pegged against the minimum wage or the national average salary. That means there is A, an incentive for MPs to do whatever they can to get those numbers to go up, and B, it means that every time an MP's salary is increased, turns out it's good news for millions of other people as well.
Does that sound reasonable, Charlotte?
I actually don't have, because I don't have a problem at all with this MP's pay rise. One, I think you're going to show us that it's not as great. You're both going to demonstrate that it's not as grotesque as we think. And also, I'm really, really tired of this sort of anti-politics sentiment that seems to go around. I've worked for an MP, and I know MPs, and they work, if you worked out the amount per hour they were paid for the amount of work they are doing, is peanuts. And we're not going to overthrow the political system, we're not going to get rid of MPs, and we wouldn't want to. So we have to find a system of incentives that means we are getting the best, most qualified, most hard-working people. We wouldn't want MPs to say, I'm worth £15 an hour, you're paying me 66k, so I'm only going to work X number of hours. No MP works like that, so we have to make the... I don't want to use the word compensation, because it's not compensation, it's an honour to be an MP. But we have to make the payment they get for doing that quite difficult job in a lot of cases. It has to be balanced. It has to fit with what they're doing. And I don't think at the moment it does. So I am comfortable with them getting more. And I would like us to not frame the debate as it has been in by lots of most people, apart from Mark Thompson, actually, in this anti-politics way, this sort of nose in the trough way, which I don't think it is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I did a blog post about this yesterday. So we're recording this on Monday, the 9th of December. I did yesterday afternoon. It's actually the first blog post I wrote since I left the Lib Dems a few weeks ago. And I was amazed at how quickly it seemed to get picked up. I mean, basically, the blog post I wrote was that MPs should get their pay rise. And also, I pointed out it's basically 2.2% a year rather than 11%. Once you take into account, you know, what's happened with MPs' pay rises in the last few years. And another thing I didn't even include in the blog post is the fact that if this pay rise comes in 2015, it will probably be for the whole of the next parliament, from what I've read. And we can't be absolutely certain of that because of the way IPSA works. But I think it's pretty likely it would last at least 2 or 3 years. So when you spread it out like that, it's probably not even 2% a year. The idea it's 11% versus 1%, I just think it's completely unfair. But that's representative of the kind of paucity of intellectual rigour that is in this debate. I mean, I've listened to some of the phone-in shows and, you know, read plenty of comments about it. And it's all just about MPs, snouts in the trough. I mean, it's quite telling as well, actually. I've done 5 different media things in the last 24 hours, one on the BBC News channel and 4 radio things, where I just basically, you know, said my piece on this. And I'm pretty sure the reason they came to me, or I had other media requests I couldn't do as well. I had about 8 in the end, which I think is the most I've ever had for anything. Even when Chris Hume resigned, I didn't get that many media requests. And I think it's quite telling because I think there are hardly any MPs that they can find who will defend this. All the MPs that I've heard, apart from one on the record, just said that this is appalling and that, you know, that this shouldn't be happening and all the rest of it, and said the right things. But I think it's very interesting that when there was an anonymous poll of 100 MPs done over the summer, that actually it turned out that I think it was like 60-odd% of them did think that they should get a pay rise. And when the amounts of money that they all thought they should get were averaged out, it turned out that they actually think they should be earning 85,000.
Not
66,000, not even 74,000. I
saw, don't the Tories think they're worth 96k?
Yeah.
Labour is about 76 or something, and the Dems about 77.
Something like that.
I think probably about 75 to 80,000 pounds for a high level public service job is probably right.
Yeah, but I completely agree with you, Charlotte, about your point about the toxicity of this debate. I mean, you know, that's what I've been picking up on. And I mean, I think it didn't start with the expenses scandal, because I think it was there before that. But that definitely exacerbated it. And it just feels now that you just will not get a hearing for this. The amount of abuse that I've had on Twitter from what I've said, you know, and I don't mind, I'm a big boy, I can take it, I don't care really, I have no skin in this game, I'm not an MP, I'm not likely to be one, but the number of people who think I must have some ulterior motive for saying what I've said is quite astonishing really. And you know what I also think about this is it was given to IPSA a few years ago, and I remember having an interesting conversation with Norman Baker at Lib Dem conference about 4 years ago. I think it was 2009, so I think it was after the expenses scandal had broke. And he said something from the platform at this, I think it was a Guardian event, where he said something about, well, once it's in the hands of an independent body, then, you know, they can announce pay rises, and that will then be fine because they'll be independent. And afterwards I went up to him and I said, Norman, do you really honestly think that even if it was in the hands of an independent body and they announced a big pay rise for MPs, that the public will just accept it and it will be fine and there won't be any furore about it? And he said, no, it'll be absolutely fine. That just made me really seriously question his political judgment, I have to say. And of course, now that it's happened, you know, I've been proven absolutely right. But what it makes me wonder is if, when the MPs used to vote on it, and that was obviously seen as unacceptable, so they gave it to an independent body. Now the independent body's made the decision, that's also seen as unacceptable. What is the answer? And I know, Mark, you've said about, you know, hooking it to specific, you know, specific index of like minimum wage or something, some multiple of minimum wage. But I mean, I wonder if even that would work. There'd be some objection to that and we'd be back to square one again.
I mean, someone said to me when I floated this idea before, someone said to me, oh, but then you would have people complaining when the minimum wage went up because MPs would benefit from it. Frankly, don't give a toss if people whinge if millions of people are better off because of it. I just think you need to try and take the toxicity out of it long term. Stop it being a political football. No politician is ever going to be able to say anything but this is a bad idea, or I'll take it if I'm given it, but, you know, there are other priorities. Even though it's clear that a lot of them don't actually think that. I just think that we also need to couple this with a debate on what the role of an MP actually is, because it used to be that an MP would be a member of the landed gentry who'd pop down for a few days from their country pile, wouldn't need to be paid a salary, would vote on the matters of the day and then head off back to the countryside. Now an MP is a social worker, a legislator, a campaigner, an activist, a journalist, a social media user. What is an average MP's day like? Many of them are fantastic. Many of them conform to what Charlotte's been saying. They work incredibly long hours. They work incredibly hard. They live incredibly difficult lives, some of them. And that's not something you hear very often. But some of them are lazy. Some of them are quite greedy. Some of them don't live anywhere near their constituencies and don't spend any time there. Some of them make very large amounts of money outside of Parliament when probably they should be spending a bit more time representing the interests of their constituents. I think we need to be talking about what an MP's job is. And part of that is explain to the electorate what they do. And part of that is going to have to be about how much they're paid. And I think it's all part of one debate rather than two separate debates.
Do you think there's any risk that, because I mean, this is one of the things I've said when I've been on the media in the last day or so. It is something I do fear. It's not something I fear is going to happen immediately, but it's something I fear might happen in many years to come. If this continues, this kind of toxic atmosphere, that MPs will feel politically pressured into refusing pay rises after pay rise after pay rise, eventually the amount that MPs are earning will, in real terms, be a lot less than it is at the moment, coupled with the pressure that is on MPs to not claim expenses, even expenses they're entitled to. You get people like Adam Afrié, who touts himself as an expenses saint. If you go to his website, there's a section on there about how few expenses he's claimed, as if that's some kind of great point that he should then be voted
for. Not all
of
us are as lucky to own news agencies that many a struggling graduate has worked for.
Exactly, and that is exactly my point, that Adam Afrié is worth tens of millions of pounds, and there are other MPs who are very wealthy who could also do the same thing. And you started to see it pop up on leaflets where people, you know, candidates are promising to not claim expenses, or to only claim the bare minimum, or not claim the second home allowance, etc., etc., etc. My fear about this atmosphere is if it carries on like this, eventually we will reach the point, I don't think we're there yet, but I think we will reach the point where there are just so many MPs in Parliament who are independently wealthy that Lloyd George's thing that he brought in 100 years ago to pay MPs will pretty much have gone out the window by stealth and by the toxic atmosphere perpetuated by partly the media and partly public opinion on this.
I mean, I do think you have to have some form of escalator. Now, whether or not that should be in line with inflation, in line with average salaries or whatever, I do think you need to have that sort of escalator so the kind of situation you're talking about doesn't occur. But it would take a long time with the speed that salaries are increasing at the moment for the average salary of £26,000 a year to hit the MP's salary of £66,000 a year. I do find this argument a little bit difficult, because if I walked into my local Tesco's tonight and asked them if they wanted to be an MP, the thing putting them off is not going to be being paid nearly three times their salary. It's going to be that politics is remote from them.
Yeah. Charlotte, what do you think?
I don't normally agree with Caroline Flint, but actually she's the person that's hit the nail on the head best for me around this whole debate around politics and the toxicity of it. And she once said on the TV, I heard her say, you shouldn't have to be a geek or a millionaire to be a politician. And that hits the nail on the head for me, because I think if we don't sort this out, we are going to either have very independently wealthy people, and just the most talented people are not going to want to be represent their constituencies.
Yeah.
They're not going to want to represent the communities they live in. They're not going to want to be part of the political debate. And that's really sad. I mean, you could double the salary of an MP and I wouldn't do it. There's absolutely no way I would do it. And I'm hardly the only politically engaged person that thinks like that.
Yeah, I mean, when I first got involved in politics a few years ago, I suppose in the back of my mind, I did harbour thoughts of perhaps one day becoming an MP. I actually failed the candidate selection back in 2009, so that wasn't a good start. But no, I didn't bother going for it again. And I mean, I'm not even a member of a party anymore. I don't think I'm likely to. It's not particularly about the money, but what it would be more for me is something that actually a few people have mentioned to me since I did my blog post, and I've been popping up talking about this, that it's not particularly what MPs are paid. It's how much it costs an individual, both in time and money, but especially money, to actually become an MP in the first place. And I think that is a real problem. I remember seeing some research on Conservative Home several years ago where it was talking about it cost tens of thousands of pounds for someone to become, you know, to become an MP, to, you know, all the time that they have to spend, time they have to take out of work, you know, unpaid to go and do various things, and all the money they have to spend travelling all around the country just to, you know, go to selections and, you know, trekking back and forth within the constituency, all the stuff, it costs money, and of course it costs time. And, you know, I think that is a massive problem as well. I'm not sure there's really a solution to that.
It's a huge issue. Absolutely huge issue.
Yeah. You could almost be forgiven for thinking that when MPs do get in, the fact that they're paid perhaps, you know, quite a bit more than the average is partly compensation for all the money they will have spent getting there in the first place, which I'm sure is not an argument that would go down well with the general public at all anyway. Okay. Well, we'll draw things to a close there on that controversial subject that someone on Twitter described to me. The point of view I was putting forward was about as popular as rabies, which I think probably sums it up. So I'd just like to thank Mark Ferguson for joining us tonight. Thanks very much for your time, Mark.
Thanks, Mark.
It's been great having you on. And also thanks, Charlotte. Finally, we got you on.
Yes, thanks for having me. It'd be great fun and nice to chat to you for the first time, Mark.
Absolutely. And get well soon, Emma Bunnell.
Yes, indeed. Quite. So look after yourself, Emma.
Indeed. I'm hoping she'll be back on next week. It'd be great to have Emma back. Okay. And I'd also like to thank Audio Boo, who very kindly hosts the podcast for us on the internet. And I'd like to thank Kevin McLeod at incomputech.com for our theme music. And we'll be back next week.